Good morning, everybody.
Hello, everybody.
You know what today is, Dan?
There are several things I know about today.
It's April 2nd, which is, yesterday was April Fool's Day, the worst April Fool's ever.
Yeah, except for maybe last year's April Fool's.
I mean, there was still a naive hope last year. It's also, it's Good Friday.
Right.
Which apparently, so for those who don't know, it's kind of seems morbid to call it Good Friday, but it's the obsolete use of the word good, meaning holy or pious. So it's like a holy Friday, Jesus dying on the cross is holy. And it's also Fascism Friday. So we've got to figure out how to incorporate all those things.
It just all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
And I'm Mark Van Steenwijk. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination. And today, I mean, we'll bring in fascism. We'll try to bring in the death of Jesus, just because it's a special time of year. But the primary emphasis today is continuing our conversation on housing justice, property, land, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it ties in with it. I mean, it does tie in with those other things.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. So, you know, one of the main reasons, of course, that Jesus was executed is because he was living in occupied land, right? So this was Roman occupied territory. And, you know, that's one of the things about what human societies do. They occupy territory, they colonize, they take over places, and then, of course, they want to control the people who are there, and they have different ways of doing that. You know, the Romans were very good at having puppet kings. So, you know, Herod, and then they'd have governors like Pilate, and yeah, and so they had to control the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely one of the big things that was going on back then.
Well, yeah, and so much of Jesus's teachings and parables about the vineyards and workers, it's all tied up with Roman latifundia kind of land use laws, and we don't read all that into there. So when you start bringing in social dynamics like that, people confuse you of having a Marxist revisionist way of reading scripture as though they didn't think about power and land back in the day.
As if Karl Marx was a 10th century BC academic.
Yeah. Or like somehow that before Marx came along, people were like, this doesn't feel good, but I don't know what to call it. And then Marx shows up like, it's called oppression. And they're like, oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay. So one of the, so there were two directions that my mind was going before this that I was sharing with Mark before we got on. So one of them, you know, I was thinking about unhoused people. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Before we get into this, because I'm going to forget, and we're going to get into this, we're going to have a million comments. So Ceres, who's one of our regular commenters, posted a great article about relationship with land and our confused relationship with land. And particularly the jumping off point of the article was about the pandemic. So, so if you can find her on Facebook, she's got that series. If you're listening, you could throw up the link to that article here, but it's really good. And basically was talking about a lot of the themes that we were talking about on Wednesday in terms of a disordered relationship with the rest of creation and with land. But one of the things I was thinking about was, you know, what is the function of unhoused people in our society, right? So, you know, every city in America you walk around and there are these people in tents, right? You can see it in Minneapolis. You can see it in, oh, there's Ceres. She's there. So yeah, if you could throw up that link with that article, it was really good. Yeah, so we know these folks are there and you see these tents. And we also know, of course, that there's plenty of housing. So it's not that there's not enough places for these folks. So what's the function of that? And, you know, I think one of the functions is to basically scare everybody else into being a good citizen drone.
Yeah, because, like, the reason they're not given housing is because... And if anyone who's worked trying to secure housing for someone who's housing insecure, there's like layers upon layers of bureaucracy, and that's bureaucracy is there for a reason. It's gatekeeping of resources. Mm-hmm. And so if you're unhoused, it is kind of this cautionary tale. There's one thing, cautionary tale, like don't end up like that. But then also it's re-enshrines the sacredness of private property. Which, yeah, I get into arguments with this all the time, and people think, well, because it's so baked in now into our conditioning that it just makes sense. And if someone says, well, there's extra houses, like, well, they don't own those houses. Gotcha there. Gotcha. And I'm like, oh, wow.
Gotcha.
this arbitrary abstract, like the idea of abstracting resources mm-hmm. to create something that is exclusively used. And if it's empty for years, that the whoever exclusively has use of it can, like, is justified not sharing it. There's so many layers of myths involved to kind of get to the idea of that being normalized. And those myths didn't even really they haven't always existed either.
No.
You start talking about gift economies or, like, more traditional societies, and people think you're talking about fantasy world, even though that existed for millennia.
Yes, before our thousands and thousands
of years,
and millions, hundreds of thousands of years.
Right? Well, if you count like pre-human or non-human life, even more. Like, there's territories and stuff that's different. Like, part of it's we don't even understand the idea of having like exclusive use, or territories without enforcing the ideas of boundaries and property laws. Like, we just don't we lack a fundamental imagination for alternatives. And if you start talking about this stuff, I'm like, people go like, yeah, those people lived in caves and beat up people with sticks. I'm like, okay, well, it's all this, like, we can learn nothing from the past in other cultures. I guess capitalism is the best we can do, and those homeless people deserve to die alone. Okay, you won.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, it's even interesting how we think it's so eternal that we project this back onto history. So I always find it really funny when people start talking about nations, when they're talking about, you know, 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago. And, you know, and then I'll say to them, I'll be like, you know, there were no such thing as nation states 1,000 years ago. Like, there were no lines of property for where a nation state was. And people will look at me like I've taken some kind of weird mushroom or something. And they'll be like, what? What do you mean? It says right here, the nation. And be like, yeah, but there were no formalized boundaries of nation states and property. And their brain just kind of like, how do they live, right?
That means anyone could come in at any time and murder your family and take your stuff. Because the only thing that keeps them from doing that is like a deed enforced by police officers, apparently.
All right, a couple comments coming in.
That's right. It still hurts to see unhoused people in the city as being the abuser. It's totally an abusive relationship. They are profiting off of keeping people poor and destitute. What benefit is there, health-wise and community-wise, to keep people poor? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's this incredibly toxic relationship. you know, everything from shops having signs saying you can't come and use the bathroom unless you buy something. kind of strange curfew type laws. You can't fall asleep on the light rail station. When I was arrested for protesting something once, there was a guy in there who was thrown in jail because he fell asleep on a bus and was sleeping in the bus, and the bus, like, warehouse where they keep the buses. And so they threw him into jail. And he went into, he didn't have his medicine with him for his diabetes. And so he started going to shock, and they wouldn't give him a piece of bread. And the people came in, and one of the cops was spitting into a cup with his chewing tobacco during work, which I'm sure is against the rules. And he was laughing about it. No. The layers of dehumanization that happened in that is astonishing. No.
Well, and so the benefit, right, because it's obviously totally inhumane. It seems like there's no benefit. Well, what the benefit is that it keeps everybody who is slightly above that level or beyond, it keeps them in line, and it keeps them striving. Mm-hmm. Right, because it's like, okay, you know, on your way to work, on your way to your shitty job that barely pays living wage or doesn't pay living wage, you see somebody in a tent, and so you think, okay, so if I don't keep doing this, I'm going to be in the tent. And so what that does is that creates then this internalized kind of policing. We've talked about that before, where people then oppress themselves and are willing to put up with oppression. And then you've got Amazon making billions of dollars off of that. That's the other thing that's happening today, although I've heard it's been delayed until Monday or Tuesday. We're supposed to get the results of the vote from the unionization effort at the Amazon factory in Alabama. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on. But basically that unionization effort is really all about the integrity of ourselves as human beings, because they're not really arguing so much about wages and benefits. What they're really arguing about is whether or not a company has a right to monitor every single thing you do, including peeing and pooping. So
it's a great question from Khan. Can you explain gift economy as it relates to housing? I mean, this is where it's tricky. Like, our system is so not built up that way. But if the examples you can think of that might be, people might be aware of, how the Amish do things. You don't go and buy, like, generally, especially more traditional Amish communities, like, everyone helps each other build their houses because they share the resources, they build the houses, and they help care for each other's stuff. And it's not like, now I owe Carl Yoder money for helping me with the house. And in a just society, and there's homelessness in Amish communities, by the way, but they're traditionally there wasn't ever in Mennonite and Amish communities, because there was no idea of bracketing off surplus and selling property for profit individually. But so before then, it was relatively functioning as a gift economy. The way it could work in our society now is people chipping in to provide housing for one another and each other's basic needs without being out of debt. In our society, it's hard to do that larger scale without talking about taxation. And then all of a sudden what people say is like, well, who's going to pay for it? As though money has intrinsic value. Like, it's like, it's always bizarre, like, because it always breaks down to there has to be this fundamental assumption of someone having ownership. Right. Never mind who cultivated the resources. Like, the trees, the trees that provide wood, like, somehow were owned by somebody, and that's bizarre. The labor was owned by the boss of the company who owns the labor. And so it's all like this abstracted form of ownership. And so we could all pay for all the things together. Like, that's what a gift economy is. Like, and then there's ways to monitor abuse of the situation that isn't based upon property rights. Totally fundamentally different way of thinking.
Yeah. And one of the really interesting examples of that I encountered. So, you know, within MICA, we operate a lot as a spiritual community with a lot of sharing. And so, at one point we bought a house, And as part of that, in the documentation of it, some of the money had to be documented as a, quote, loan, even though we weren't charging any interest and it wasn't mm-hmm. really a loan. And one of the things the attorney told us that wrote this up was like, well, it is actually illegal to have a zero interest loan.
Yep.
Like, you have to make money. That's in the law. And I was just like, okay, well, I'm not going to worry about that right now. but that was just astonishing to me, right? That, you know, so again, when we talk about what is the benefit to a lot of these systems, the benefit is that you actually prevent people from engaging in humane relationship with each other so that somebody else can exploit you. is what it is, right? And that that this notion of, you know, the average person might just think, to, well, if I want to share stuff, and if I want to share money, and if I want to share resources, and I want to share my labor, like, I can just do that. There are actually laws that prevent us from doing that.
Yep.
Right? Which is, you know, on a certain level, totally mind-blowing. You know, and another example of this that's more ancient than the Amish, but, and I think I mentioned this in one of the transmissions, but it may have been somewhere else. When somebody was in this one book about colonization of America, and people were looking at the standard of living of Native Americans in the upper Midwest, particularly along Lake Superior, versus the standard of living in what was becoming capitalist London. And basically, they found that the Native Americans had a much higher standard of living, right? And everything was shared. There was no concept of land ownership at all. There was no concept of ownership of anything at all. Right. And, you know, so people just helped each other build housing. They fished, hunted, shared food. And, you know, the point that this author was making was that if you had beamed one of these people into, you know, a slum in London, they would have been absolutely horrified by how people were being forced to live there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lack of imagination and will. And it's not like... I feel like I have to say this. It's not like a collective. It's a mistake to look at this as the collective failure of individual lack of imagination. Like, we're indoctrinated this way, and it takes a lot of imagination and organizing to create alternatives. And so whenever I bring up property value stuff, people always foolishly, I think, start saying, well, do you own your house? Do you share your house with other people? And for a long time, I'd say, well, yes, I do share. But like, even if I didn't, it's the response to this isn't to like divest ourselves of everything as though that in and of itself solves something. I mean, even in Jesus, when he called people, he didn't say divest. He said divest and give to the poor. And then he was trying to create this new society, the kingdom of God. So it doesn't make sense just to reject property rights altogether unless we have this idea of how we build the kingdom of God and how we leverage what we have towards that. And so that's the creative challenge and task. And the laws are against it. Like, it, for every year we did intentional community, we were illegal because you could only have three unrelated people in a house. It's like a stupid shit law. And it's like because they don't want brothels or something. That was kind of why I think it was broken. Like, no, it's not. It's because of property, how property, they want property to be like, they want more people to have property. That's it. Other kinds of laws like that, you know, like Dan was talking, it's everything's stacked against us. Here's a comment from series. We keep getting health outbreaks because of homelessness crisis capitalism created. A dear veteran activist years ago got tuberculosis from her work with homeless veterans, and she died from it due to the medical malpractice of the VA. Yeah. And this pandemic, when we first started this, remember back in ancient times when we started transmission, we were talking about things that were revealed. And one of the things that was revealed that somehow it didn't stick is how all incredibly interdependent we are. The reason that you get pissed at someone at a bus stop who's not wearing a mask is because you know that affects you. Everything is like that. Not just disease, the economy, everything. We're all interconnected. And this idea that we can bracket off a group of humanity as what, you know, Marxists would call the lumpen proletariat, the underclass that doesn't do anything. It's a very judgmental way of framing it. I mean, that we can bracket them off as throwaway people. It tells us everything we need to know about our society and its failures. Gus writes, there's political economy philosopher, contemporary with Marx, named Henry George, who argues for a capitalist model with all land held by the state, property use tax that starts low and then grows exponentially as you collect properties you're using, removing incentives to hold on to unused housing. It's a fascinating idea. There are examples. I'm not a capitalist at all, but there are attempts, and like, you know, Henry George and others, of trying to restrain capitalism as much as possible so that as you start generating, becoming a rich bastard, more of your resources go to like keep people afloat. Mm-hmm. And even doing it in ways where it's not as though you're a perpetual underclass who's relied upon charity. Like there's an actual, like UBI is an example of this too.
Right. Yeah.
Of, okay, well, let's give it. It's not charity. It's a real actual entitlement that you have, like Social Security. You get this UBI, and it's a way of restraining the worst elements of capitalism. It only goes so far. But we need more of that kind of thinking, and we need looser laws when it comes to how property is shared. Jim writes, the most beautiful places, we humans tend to love them to death. That's sadly true.
Yeah, and you know, and a big part of that is, of course, because we are relating to those places as commodities, and so we don't relate to them in a way that is going to healthfully maintain the ecosystems. We relate to them in a way that we're just going to use them up and spit them out.
James writes, this is interesting for Bible thumpers. How many verses in the Bible warn against charging interest? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I wish our fundamentalism extended to
all of the social manifestations of our
even
faith.
Just economics. I mean, this is where it's like,
yeah,
you know, people get all creeped out when someone uses the word Sharia as though it's like Muslim conquest. But one of the things that a lot of people talk about, like if you're talking to people who Sharia just means kind of holy law. And so a lot of banks that follow like Muslim banks that follow Sharia, it's like, well, you can't charge interest. Like it's about the economic system of Islam, which is way, way more just than what we have now. And so I would love if we could be a fundamentalist when it comes to economics a little bit. Leah writes, the Portland CE, and what's CE stand for? Has set up a community banking project through the Notre Dame Credit Union, and through them, you will be able to offer small and no interest loans. Very interesting. That's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, again, in terms of different models, so the whole micro lending model, which was originally developed by a South Asian economist and put into play first in South Asia, right, is trying to come up with, you know, and then he's got this idea of a social business, or kind of this hybrid between a for-profit and a non-profit business model. And yeah, I mean, this is a way of attempting to share and use resources in a more just way, and it's, you know, it's been incredibly effective in places that it's been done and used.
Conrad's, would this be a correct statement? I think I heard a speaker say once, capitalists say, what's mine is mine. Communists say, what's yours is mine. Christians say, what's mine is God's and is yours when you need it. I mean, I could quibble about the communism one a lot. Right. Soviet style, depending on what you mean by communism, I would tend to think they'd be more like what's ours is ours.
Right.
But yeah. This last one, this idea of Christian, like there is, it's fascinating theologically what happens. You know, a lot of traditional societies, not all of them, but will look at land as kind of being a mother that you're dependent upon. So you're like children who are suckling at the breast of Mother Earth. Very beautiful idea. In the Torah, it kind of is like the earth is the Lord's, and it's, you can be, through God's grace, you receive an inheritance of the land. So you can see how lots of propertarians would see that as an endorsement of private property, which it is not. There's this whole system of how to use the land in ways that are, has some reciprocity. But there is this idea then that the, this, whatever land is, it's not sentimentally God. It's not like I'm dedicating this touchdown to Jesus kind of way of thinking where it's really mine, but I'm going to say it belongs to the big guy. It's actually God's. And so therefore you have a moral obligation to love your neighbor with it while it's under your stewardship, and using the word stewardship in a real sense, not in the BS way that churches talk about their budget being stewardship when then they just spend it however they want. Like it's not, it's a real, it's really has to be in service to God. And again, that'd be amazing if we actually lived that way. Mm-hmm. Right now, can you imagine if we applied gleaning laws to grocery stores? So that if you're hungry, you could go pick up a box of, of your favorite snacks and some bread and peanut butter and jelly, and you wouldn't get arrested for it because, like, no, you have to observe gleaning laws in the Torah. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, and that's, all of this stuff does apply to property of all kinds. You know, I've often thought that about the issue of food, too. So, the fact that we have grocery stores, which are these, like, beautiful, fancy, well-lit places, and everything looks perfect, and, you got somebody that comes along, if there's a fruit that has a blemish, they take it away and put the other perfect fruit there, and and those are for the people that have money and can buy things. And then you've got food shelves, which, often tend to be, a stack of funky shelves made out of used 2x4s with, a bunch of boxes of donated stuff in them. And that's where, the poor people that can't afford food go. And I've often thought to myself, like, why doesn't everybody use the same store? And it's just like, here's the price if you can afford to pay, and if you can't afford to pay, just get your food. That would be so horrifying to most people. But it's like, in America, 40% of the food in the store gets thrown out anyway. So why not just let people that need food come get it? And you don't divide the population between those who are good people who are buying food and those who are the bad underclass who, have to beg for food. That's obscene.
Well, it's
like everybody should get to eat.
Well, who's going to pay for it, Dan?
Who's going to pay for it?
That's not even really the question.
The same people that pay for my atomic bombs, Mark. Those are the people that are going to pay for it.
Nice. It's interesting, like when people subvert this, even modestly, like, so there's a meme I've seen being shared for years. I think it's, I don't know if it's like a, an Arby's or some sort of restaurant where they put a sign up on their door. And I've seen this picture shared dozens and dozens of times. And it says, to the person who's been going through the dumpster for your meal, you are a human being worthy of dignity. The next time you need a meal, come in. And you can have coffee and a meal, and it's our treat, right? So this very, very, very basic level of human compassion, not very heroic at all, very basic, is astonishingly newsworthy.
Yep.
That's really fucked up. Good for them, but it shouldn't be. It shouldn't have to be good for them.
No,
that should be normative. No. And there are restaurants that exist that use this model, even Panera, like that's what they're best known for, is that they do these things where they will share stuff for free with people who are food insecure. That should be normal. And we can afford it. You could still even do that in a capitalist system, and you could still have these rich bastards being rich and still do that. It doesn't even really threaten capitalism to do that. Not, as much as I want to threaten capitalism, even within this crappy system, we could do so much better. And we don't.
All right. So 1029, Dr. Pern is coming in with a brilliant comment. We got to get to that.
Yeah. Regarding comment about property belonging to God, this is a really tricky in a colonial context, for sure. Thanks for bringing this up. Where settlers often claimed indigenous land in God's name for white Christians only. Similarly, a lot of Christian charity and quasi-socialist models in North America, for example, Lutheran Mutual Aid orgs, were for members only, which reinforces the white supremacist wealth gap. What would it look like, model that challenges this? You know, thanks for bringing that up. Just to plug my book, book on Kingdom, I talk a little bit about this, but the justification for exploitation of the new land. Mark. Thank you.
That's good.
The fact that part of the rationale for just taking over this continent is because they didn't have property right rules and they weren't making the land productive enough. The justification for a lot of conquest explicitly is because they aren't making the land productive. And so we have this idea, and it's this disordered relation to the land. It exists to serve us. We exist above it, and we have to bracket it off and own it. And conquest is a legitimate way of asserting property and establishing property rights.
Yeah. And you're right. Yeah. So that kind of belonging to God rationale starts with kind of a conquest of God. This sense that I own God, I know the real God, you all are worshiping the bad God, and therefore God, i.e. my God, tells me to take you over. And so, to me, applying that sort of language within the context of the entire world would immediately imply a sort of universalism, which is, very justifiable from a scientific and ecological point of view, but is not a universalism, certainly, that a majority of Christian churches believe in. Mm-hmm. So, you can't own God and think that, my God is better than your God, and so I get to beat you up and take your land.
Looks like we're going to have a final comment from James.
Yeah.
So one of the ways that capitalism and colonialism affect Christian missionary was this concept of private property. In some cases, there was some good motives, giving commoners rights they didn't have before. But within a few decades, whole cultures lost most of their autonomy and land rights. And then, Gus got one in under the wire here. Can we all agree, though, the fundies god is an asshole?
Yeah,
I'm in agreement with that.
Or as I like to say, the psychotic warlord.
I guess Neil got one. I'm just gonna, this is the fun. No one else comment, dang it. Neil writes, I'm putting this because I don't think we ever had a comment from Neil, so I wanted to include this. In the before times, I'd go to lunch with a colleague. We work in downtown Houston. We almost always got asked for change. She would ignore them. I'd stop to give what change I had. She asked why I did that. I said, because they asked and I had some change. It's not like I was being generous. I've been in situations where I might have needed that change, but it's not my situation now. And what's more, it's not like I was being generous. And this is the thing that this gets at the core of this weird ego thing that happens. The reason people generally don't like giving change is because they don't want to be taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an extension of kind of a ownership logic, because you feel violated if someone asks for money, you give them $2 and they use it to buy booze. Like, what's going on there? It's not just altruistic concern for their health. There's this needing to assert this is mine and I should be able to use it towards my will. And if I give it to you and you use it in a way other than how I intended, then you've screwed me over. Like, there's this strong control piece to it that needs to be let go of. So you're right.
Yeah.
Your example's great. It's like, you're not being that generous. Why not do it?
Yeah. Well, and that other issue that you bring up, Neil, is really important and is something we probably spend all week's worth of episodes on. This whole issue of, lauding people, we've talked about in terms of billionaires, but I think it's true of everybody. I mean, sometimes when I've been in community situations, or you know, we've been in situations where we set up, you know, free or reduced medical care or whatever, people will say, "Well, you're very generous." And I'll be like, "No, I'm actually not generous. This is what the spiritual life tells me to do. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm not doing anything unusual from that perspective." And I think that, you know, that's the other thing that this whole property thing does, is it feeds people's ego. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that I've sat on boards of nonprofits where the main concern in people's minds is, am I going to get put in the right giving bracket on the annual report so that everybody can see how generous I am? Oof. And you know, there's this one guy in this one thing where I was thinking to myself, you know, is he going to fucking insist we build a statue, you know, in the square so that everybody knows that he gave all this money to the organization? It's like, that's not being generous. That just means that you have too much money and finally you're giving a little bit of it away, but you shouldn't get any credit for that.
No, then you're actually not being altruistic. You're actually using money to buy prestige in another fashion. And that's really ultimately, once you move beyond money securing your basic needs, money only becomes about enforcing your will on others in the world and about increasing your prestige. I mean, really, once you're past your basic needs, it's about enforcing your will in the world and increasing your prestige. And those two things are not good. You shouldn't have it. So no. There we go.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And
I should remove the brick with my name on it at my alma mater.
Oh, that's cool. don't worry about it.
No, you own that brick.
Yeah, you own that brick, and maybe if you pull it, the whole building will fall down, and that would be kind of fun. So, all right, well, great having everybody with us today. Thanks a lot, and we will be back next week.
See you next week, everybody.
Some other topic.
Peace.
Bye.